Okay, good morning, ladies. Are we ready? We having a good day so far? It was an early start, and we're not even halfway through. My name's Amy Buckman. I'm the manager of public relations and special events for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Daily News, and Philly.com. Philadelphia Media Network, which is the publisher of those entities, is a sponsor of the Pennsylvania Women's Conference here today. We have a booth in the exhibit hall. We hope you'll stop by. You can do selfies with a giant front page of the Inquirer. You can stick your head through the hole and be either Donald or Hillary. A lot of people making funny faces, that's all I'm gonna say. We're really thrilled to be here because the mission of the Pennsylvania Conference for Women and the mission of our journalists is really one and the same. It's to educate and empower our readers, just as this conference tries to do for women who attend it. We are really committed to objective journalism, which sometimes when you go out into the internet and start looking at different news sources, you may not see, but we remain committed to that and to preserving journalism here in the city of Philadelphia so that everyone who lives here can read information, make their own decisions, and act accordingly. And so we hope you'll continue to support journalism in Philadelphia because I know this is a group of women who want to make informed decisions and take action based on those decisions. So enough about me and my company. This session is entitled Retirement Planning Tips and Tricks for Making Your Money Last. I'm hoping they picked me to moderate because I used to do money saving reports on Channel 6 and not because of my age. But really, we know that no matter how old you are, it's never too early to start planning ahead and planning for your retirement. And we have an amazing hour in store for you. I am very excited to introduce Jane Bryant Quinn. She is a leading commentator on personal finance. Her books and columns are read and trusted by millions. Her newest book, How to Make Your Money Last, The Indispensable Retirement Guide, has become one of the country's top-selling retirement books. Her previous book, Making the Most of Your Money, is a comprehensive guide to personal finance, named by Consumers Union as the best personal finance book on the market. So get on Amazon, order the books, that's all good. Jane also does a column in the AARP Monthly Bulletin that addresses many issues facing those people mid and later in life. We were just discussing, we both have older parents who have made or not made some of the plans they should have made along the way. She discusses things such as saving money, managing debt, planning for retirement, and investing. She also covers financial topics on her own website, aptly titled janebryantquinn.com, easy to remember. And in 2010, she co-founded thedailyvoice.com, which brings local news to communities online. She has been in just about every magazine, I think, ever published, Newsweek, Good Housekeeping, Women's Day. She has a newspaper column that is syndicated by the Washington Post. You've probably seen her on television. She's been a financial correspondent for the CBS Morning News and the Evening News with Dan Rather. She does her own program, hosted her own program on PBS called, not PMS, what am I thinking? Must be all the estrogen in the room. Her program on PBS, which was called Take Charge, and she has received numerous awards, including an Emmy for excellence in TV journalism. So let's welcome Jane Bryant Quinn.
Man, you know you're in a women's group when you get PMS. Let's hear it. I'm really very, very pleased to be with you all here today. I can't tell you how what a pleasure it is for me to spend time in the company of accomplished women who are managing their own money. You know, when I came up, it was rare for us to do that. Every corner of financial planning except budgeting and paying the bills was basically considered a man's job. Whether the men liked it or not, they had to do it. Sometimes they were good at it, sometimes they weren't. Today we think about it differently. As you know, God created man, and then he stepped back and he looked and he said, I can do better than that. When women do better at it, they get the job. And in our house, as you might guess, I do the personal finances. And this is lucky because my husband hates to do it and he's no good at it. But what he does, he cooks. I consider that a really good trade-off. I have to tell you a true story, since I've sort of spanned the decades of this whole development of women coming into their own and coming into their own financially. This one dates back to the days when Congress was trying to pass the Equal Rights Amendment. And the late Representative Millicent Fenwick of New Jersey, one of my heroes, told me, true story, she said that one of the male representatives in Congress had rolled up to her and said, "Millicent, I don't know about this equal rights thing. I always thought that women ought to be soft and warm and sweet smelling." And Fenwick said, "Well, I understand that. I always thought that a man ought to be soft and warm and sweet smelling." And then she said, "I hope you haven't been disappointed as often as I have." Today, I am disappointed only by one thing, and that is that we still live in a residue of that time. There is a whisper sort of floating in the air that women are somehow not quite as good or as smart as managing money or investing or making money decisions at men. Somehow there is something in our makeup that we have to fix. For example, I am often asked to write for a short piece for a website or a magazine under the title, "The Top 10 Money Mistakes That Women Make." Not just the 10, mind you, the top 10, assuming that they are infinite. I have never been asked to write something headed, "The Top 10 Money Mistakes That Men Make." Men wouldn't read it because they're not making mistakes, right? The difference is, of course, women do read it, and this is part of what's in the atmosphere making us think that we might probably be making mistakes because there's something in our womanness that isn't getting it. And that's what I mean when I say there is a residue, when the press keeps on doing stories like this. It really makes me mad. I deeply, deeply know that money is not pink or blue. Money is green. Scientists have looked at the Y chromosome very carefully. There is no money management gene. Now, some people, men and women, are doing well with their financial decisions, and others, men and women, could be doing better. And we'll talk about that. But if I were writing a top 10 list for men and for women, it would be exactly the same. Oh, as for women in math, by the way, don't even think about it, this whole business, women don't do math. First, it's irrelevant to personal finance. Second, I am terrible at math and have always been so. Anytime I publish a calculation, you can be absolutely sure that someone else has checked it, because I've discovered to my embarrassment that if that didn't happen, I've sometimes published wrong numbers. Money management is not math. It is knowing what you want from the money you make, setting up a plan to get there, and applying your common sense. The best strategies are not complicated. They are simple and they are low cost. The less you pay in fees, the more you have to invest, the larger your retirement pot will be. But they are really simple, simpler than you think, and common sense does it. I do want to say a very, very brief word about the election. You know why they call voting suffrage? It's because we have to suffer through yet another presidential election season. I sometimes think Lily Tomlin got it right. She said, "No matter how cynical you become, it is not enough to keep up." But please, do not let this political cage fight influence any of your financial decisions. The economic collapse is well behind us. Business remains on a moderate growth path with employment, consumer spending, average wages up over last year. Not everyone is doing well, as you know, but the country is not falling back. For your future lives and mine, the basic principles apply even in a testy election year. You save money, get out of debt, fit your expenses to your income, and invest for the long term. And anything else is just theater. Now, the long term is especially important to women because on average, we live 2 or 3 years longer than men. At 65, average life expectancy runs to about 85, and people who are in the upper half of the income range, who had a good education and health insurance all their lives, are mainly the group of people who lives longer than the life expectancy numbers. The 90-plus population has tripled over the past 3 decades. Last April, my family celebrated my mother's 101st birthday. And she is sharp and happy, and 4 years ago married a lovely young man of 87. So you never know. You are saving money today for a longer term than you might imagine. Now, my new book, as it says in your program, is called How to Make Your Money Last, and it's for people who are looking ahead and want to figure out how to stretch their money over this extremely long period of life after their paycheck stops. Now, this assumes, of course, that you have some savings to stretch. So I'm going to talk now about not how to make your money last, how to make your money first. How many of you are working and have access to a company retirement plan? Most of you, that's great. How many of you are working and do not have access to a company retirement plan? Just a few. I am very happy to see most of you do, and for the few, you know you are being discriminated against. Those of you with plans are the lucky ones in our society, and you need to appreciate it and use the plans. When you are in the system, and when you're in the system, you are being helped. Employees' plans deduct money from your paycheck. It goes automatically into mutual funds. There's no willpower involved in your saving. You just check the box, and it's all done for you. Your employer might contribute. The people who enter retirement with decent pots of savings are overwhelmingly people who have been in employee retirement plans. They benefited from being in the system. If you don't have an employee plan, you are stuck outside the system. You can set up a retirement plan, but you have to find it, you have to fund it, you need the discipline to put the money in yourself, all without help. And that is a lot harder, and in my judgment, totally unfair to the people who work for themselves or who work for small companies that do not have plans. Because of this difficulty, people outside the system are the ones who tend to arrive at retirement with less money than those who had an employer's help. Now, there are several states working now to set up low-cost automatic retirement plans for people currently outside the system. I am sorry to say Pennsylvania is not one of them. I looked it up. That's something you might ask your political candidates about. Inside the system, your employer offers you mutual funds, 401ks, 403bs, whatever, and which we'll talk about later. They might enroll you in the plan automatically with 3% or 5% of your paycheck. That is not nearly enough. In your 30s, you should be saving at least 10% of pay. In your 40s, 15%. In your 50s, even more. If you are not contributing that much to your company plan, put it on tomorrow's to-do list, not next week's, but tomorrow. Raise the amount. You can raise it gradually until you reach the max. And if your company has a plan that will do that for you automatically, increase the amount you're saving every year, you should sign up for it. When you are outside the system, you chiefly have individual retirement accounts or solo 401ks that you can buy from banks or from mutual fund groups. If your income is steady when you're outside the system, you can automate savings yourself by having the bank automatically put money into your account. If not, your best approach is to save a percentage of every paycheck whenever it comes in before you pay your bills, and you all know that that is hard. but you are going to retire someday, whether you have to do it yourself or whether you have to increase the 3% of pay you're putting away now and put it up to 10%, you should do it because you need to save and invest. All you will have to support you for the rest of your life, other than your Social Security, is going to be what you save now. And the same thing, by the way, applies to your spouse if you're married. Now, some of you are thinking, it's fine for Jane to be talking about saving more money, but I'm living paycheck to paycheck, and there is nothing to spare. And sometimes that's true, but sometimes that only appears to be true. There might be money trickling through your fingers that you are not even aware of. And I'll tell you a personal story about this. When I was in my early 20s and definitely living paycheck to paycheck, I did not sign up for my company's retirement plan. And an older colleague said, Jane, you have to do this. And I said, no way, I can't do it. I can't pay the dentist. How can I put money in a retirement plan? And she said, try. So with fear and trembling, I put 5% into the plan from my very small paycheck. And you know what happened? Nothing happened. I was still a little slow paying the dentist. Apologies to you dentists out there. But my life went on unchanged as far as I could see, and I was somehow magically putting money aside. I was so surprised that I raised my savings to 7% of my paycheck and still didn't notice it, and then I raised it to 10%, I noticed it, and I stopped. But the point is that saving automatically works. You can save more than you are saving now, even if you think you can't. You spend what is in your checking account. If you put a little less into your checking account, you will spend a little less without even making a budget. You won't know how you do it. It's the only magic I know of in personal finance. It just happens. It worked for me, and it will work for you. Now, when you start an individual retirement account, you can choose between a traditional plan and a plan known as a Roth, R-O-T-H, Roth IRA. At work, you might be able to choose a Roth 401k, and if your company offers the Roth 401k, what's the difference? With a traditional IRA or 401k, you get a tax deduction for the money you contribute. Your investments grow tax deferred. You pay taxes when you retire and take the money out. With a Roth, by contrast, you get no tax deduction for the money you put in, but everything grows tax free. Now, I am personally partial to the Roth because it's really nice to have a tax free investment. But if you need that deduction in order to put a little more into savings, then I would take the traditional account. In the years before retirement, you should be power saving, pushing your paycheck very hard. You don't necessarily know when you are going to retire. You might be thinking, I'll work till I drop. I'll never retire, I'll work till I drop. Then your company gets reorganized and suddenly you're 60 and you have no job at all. And so, because you don't know when this thing is going to happen, you can't put off saving for retirement. If you face a financial setback at any age, deal with it right away. Cut back unnecessary spending, start a job hunt, tell your friends and colleagues you're looking. You know, so many people have been in and out of jobs over the past 10 years that everybody understands it. You don't have to hide. Losing a job can stun you. Back in the bad old days, when I was first making my way, I was fired from a job I needed. And I remember it to this very moment, standing here, how I felt. It is very tempting to sit on your unemployment insurance for a while you collect yourself emotionally, but faster is better. If you're in midlife, finding a new job will be much harder, as you know. Among other things, you have to be very visible on the internet. LinkedIn, Facebook. Employers will look you up when you're, younger women are expected to have an internet presence. If you are in midlife, employers will look you up to see if you are digitally savvy enough for modern jobs. And that's something you need to be very aware of when you are doing your job hunting. A quick word about credit card debt. I'm going to jump among a few subjects here. If you have a lot of it and also have some savings in the bank, you might think about dipping into those savings to clean up your cards. Any money you put toward paying off a debt earns a return on investment equal to the interest rate. For example, if you're paying 15% on a credit card and you put $200 toward it, you have earned 15% on that $200 you just paid. If you have a 24% credit card, you have earned 24% on that $200 you just paid, guaranteed. And that is a pretty good return on investment. Once you get rid of your debt, you can start building up your savings again. Another quick word, this one about life insurance. If you are single, or if you're divorced or widowed and your kids have grown, you generally do not need life insurance. If you have a policy and your budget is tight, you might think about canceling the policy and putting that premium money toward your savings and investments instead. You know, the insurance is for other people. Savings and investments are for you. There are always special wrinkles to life insurance that can complicate decisions, but that is at least a starting point for thinking about it. Now, you do need insurance if you have a paycheck and your family is at least partly dependent on that paycheck. As a rule of thumb, the policy for a family of four should be worth 8 times the family income, plus a lump sum for college if you expect to pay for it. If you are a two-income family, you divide the coverage between you and your spouse based on the percentage of income you bring in. So if you bring in 50% of the money and your spouse brings in 50%, you should each be carrying half of the family insurance. Now on to the big topic of investing for the future, your 401k, your IRA, any other savings. Women often get a bad rap as investors. Many surveys appear to show that we are a little more timid than men. We are apparently a little less sure of our investment choices. We are less aggressive. I'm sure you have read those stories. Don't believe a word of it. Those surveys are done on female investors as a whole, including women who have very little experience of investing. That includes older women who are just starting to manage money after their husband died, and that is a large group of female investors. A couple of studies have compared male and female investors who have the same amount of investing experience. And guess what? Surprise, surprise, it turns out that we are exactly the same. Some of us take big risks, others of us don't take big risks, but there's not a difference between male and female. The more we gain in experience, the more we gain in confidence, men and women alike, and the better decisions we make. We are not woman investors who need special handling, as some advisors seem to think. We are plain old investors with the same range of hopes and fears and learning abilities as the guys. In one famous study, by the way, and this one includes all investors, women came out a little bit better than men. Not because we were smarter in what we chose, but it turned out we don't trade as much. So the guys, that old click, click with the mouse, buying and selling, doing a lot of trading, we were more apt to buy and hold. As a result, we paid fewer transaction costs, and we wound up a little ahead because we weren't paying the fees. So how do you invest? Whenever I talk about this subject, I think about the ad that I saw in the Financial Times. It said, "The Clairvoyant Society of Greater London will not meet next Tuesday because of unforeseen circumstances. If there is anything unforeseeable, it is what the stock market is going to do this week, next year. But two things are foreseeable. First, when you are saving for retirement, stocks are going to produce much higher returns than bonds or bank accounts, number one. Number two, second, whenever the stock market falls, it has always come back and eventually gone higher. I asked a top investment manager to calculate for me, if you're a buy and hold investor, how long it takes if the stock market falls and it goes down and it goes back up, how much time does it take to get your money back if you're investing in mutual funds or reinvesting the dividends? And here's the answer. Historically, since World War II, the shortest stock decline took just 5 months. That's the shortest, 1998. The longest took a little over 5 years. That was 2000 to 2006. So if you have at least 5 years to wait and are broadly invested, even through the worst period since World War II, you can be pretty sure of getting your money back as long as you hold on. You shouldn't get scared and sell when stock prices fall. You should get on with your life, keep making investments, and wait for the market to come back. It always does. We had a great example of this after the financial collapse of 2008. Stocks fell 50%, people sold like crazy, this is the end of the world, we'll never see a good stock market again. The market hit bottom the following year, 2009. Nobody bought because they didn't know it was the bottom and they were still scared. Since 2009, stock prices have more than doubled, plus paid dividends. So anyone who hung on did well. Anyone making regular investments through a 401k or an IRA did even better. So investors with the long view, it is actually very simple to get good results from the stock market. Now, getting good results is basically, again, I said it's simple, it's a three-step process. First, do not buy individual stocks. Don't even try to figure out whether Apple is better than Google or utilities are better than bank stocks. There is no way for you or me to know how the inner workings of the company, what its future is, how well its managers are addressing its problems, how it stands in the global universe of competitors, whether its profits are likely to rise or fall, whether its stock is fairly priced. We don't know that. And when you don't know that, you have no objective reason to buy, sell, or hold. And by the way, so-called financial advisors aren't any good at it either. They are salespeople. They are not analysts. With dumb luck, you might own two or three absolutely marvelous stocks, and the others will cost you money and break your heart. I have said that the stock market as a whole always recovers and goes higher, but that is not true for individual stocks. While the market is going up, an individual stock may lag, it may fall, it may go to zero. 15 years ago, price of Microsoft was riding high. Today, it has not yet matched its price of January 2000, and you know what the rest of the market has done since then. You cannot possibly predict what an individual stock is going to do. So stay away from them. They are not a good part of your retirement plan. Second, instead of looking at individual stocks or finding someone who will buy them for you and tell you, oh, don't worry, I have wonderful stocks, you should be looking at mutual funds. Mutual funds are pools of money with thousands of investors. They own hundreds of stocks. You own a little piece of all the stocks in the funds. Mutual funds are the right choice for individuals, and not just for people who say, I don't know much about investing or the stocks. They are the right choice for all of us. I use mutual funds exclusively for all of my own personal investments. But there are thousands of mutual funds, so now I have a second question, which ones to choose? There is one type of fund perfectly designed for people like you and me, and it's called an index fund. You don't have to bother with any of the other types of funds, just think index fund. What is it? In the stock market, an index traces the average price for a specific group of stocks. And the most important index for investors is Standard & Poor's 500. Those are the 500 top US companies. And when people say, oh, the market is up, the market is down, it's that index of 500 stocks that they are talking about. All of the studies, including the ones I just quoted, showing how well the market does over 5 or 10 or 15 or 30 years, they all look at how well the S&P 500 index performed. So an index mutual fund owns all of the stocks in the index. For example, an index fund based on Standard & Poor's. It will own all 500 of those stocks. If you invest in that fund, you will get the performance of Standard & Poor's 500, same results as the market, minus annual costs. Now you might say, your advisor might say, why do you want to just follow the market? You want to beat the market. It's very boring to try to follow the market. We'll get out ahead. We'll do even better than the market as a whole. You read about these hotshot money managers. They run famous funds. They're paid a fortune. They must be the best, right? But no matter what their advertisements say, they are not the best. Index mutual funds have been around about 40 years now. Tons of studies, and you can look them up on the internet, show that on average, professional mutual fund managers do not beat the market, and they do not beat the mutual funds that follow the market over time. They might beat the market over short periods, but you and I are long-term investors. We're looking toward retirement. So we can be in the market if you're, so a short period of time doesn't solve your problem. They beat the market a short period of time, then they fall off. Then what do? If you want to stay in the market all the time, you should be in an index fund. Index funds win over long periods. I should add that managed mutual funds also charge more fees than index funds do. So if you're in a managed fund, basically what you're doing is paying your manager to miss. And why would you do that? Instead, buy low-cost index mutual funds, invest in them regularly, and hang on. Now, I talked about common sense. This is the kind of thing I mean. You will achieve the stock market's excellent long-term returns without breaking a sweat. Stock picking is a loser's game. Index funds are a winner's game. And by the way, professional investors, institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies are increasingly putting money, trillions of dollars now actually, into index investments because after looking at performance, they've concluded that the money managers they had were not worth their fees. I'll give you two types of index funds that will keep you properly invested for life and well diversified. One is called a total market U.S. fund. It invests in all types of U.S. companies, smaller companies as well as larger ones. And the second type is a total market stock international fund. It invests in the stocks of companies outside the United States. That's all you need. U.S. stocks, international stocks, everything else is fluff. You can play around if you want, but you don't need to be a good investor. At this point, a majority of 401k plans do offer index funds. There might be a total market fund, or there might be an index fund for big companies and another one for small companies, so you can split your investments between them. Outside of 401k, index funds can be had from many sponsors. Three low-cost sponsors to look at are Vanguard, Fidelity Investments, and Charles Schwab. Now, so far, I've talked only about stock funds, U.S. and international, and there's a big diversification of your investing there. There is another important diversification, and that is bonds. They are not very appealing right now because interest rates are low, but there is a reason to own them. First, let me tell you a story. The story is about a rich man. He's on his deathbed, and he wants to take his money with him. So he emails God, and he says, God, can I bring it with me? And God, being superior, doesn't do email, he texts back, and he says, you can bring one carry-on. So the rich man looks at his wealth, he looks at his stocks and his bonds, he looks at his real estate. Finally, he decides, he has the answer, gold. He takes his gold, he packs his carry-on, he arrives at the pearly gates, and Peter's there to greet him, and he says, what have you got? And he said, I've got my wealth. God said I could bring it. And Peter said, well, let me see it, show me. And he zips open the carry-on, and all these gold bars fall out. And Peter looks at him, and he says, what? You brought pavement? You never know what is going to be valuable in the future at the time you're going to need it. This is why we diversify, and this is why bonds, even though they sound boring and have low interest rates right now, are an important part of this picture. You can buy bonds, incidentally, as bond index funds, as I do. And you buy bonds for protection in years when the stock market is not doing well. Now, the amount of your retirement savings you put into bonds, bond funds, depends on your temperament and your age. If you're starting a 401k at 25 or 35 or 40, I need to talk to 40-year-olds. You could be 100% in stocks. Why not? At 40, you're going to live another 50 years. The global economy is going to grow a lot over the next 50 years. Profits will grow. Stock prices will grow. You've got a long time to wait. When you start moving into your late 40s, early 50s, you might start shifting some of your money into bond funds. Bond funds now rise and fall in price the same way stock funds do, although not as much. When interest rates fall, the market value of your bond fund goes up. When interest rates rise, the market value of your bond fund goes down. Now, investors are worried about bond funds today because interest rates are likely to rise pretty soon, in which case the bond funds will fall in price. So that's a reason people are switching to short-term bond funds instead of longer-term funds. But if you are a long-term investor, this bond fund is still going to do okay. I'll tell you why. When interest rates rise, yes, price of your bond fund goes down, but your manager is using all the money, the cash flow coming into the bond fund to buy all these new bonds at higher rates. So the income you get from your bond fund goes up. And if you're reinvesting that income, as you would be in a bond, in a mutual fund, you're buying more shares in that mutual fund. Over time, the bond fund's market losses are offset by the increase in income that you get from owning bonds that are new bonds that are paying a higher interest rate. That is not intuitive, but that is actually how it works. And of course, when interest rates go back down again, the value of your bond fund will go up, and now you own more shares in the bond fund, so you're going to do fine. When you are looking at bond funds, though, a caveat. I firmly believe that you should stick with the funds that buy the bonds of the very highest quality, such as funds invested in U.S. Treasury securities. When the stock market falls, funds invested in treasuries rise. And therefore, you lose money on your stocks for a while, but the rise in the Treasury bond fund limits the amount of total loss that you take. That's just what happened in 2008, and it will happen again when stocks fall. Many people prefer to buy bonds that are paying higher yields. High-yield bonds invest in low-quality companies. When stock prices fall, the prices of high-yield bond funds fall too, so they don't give you the kind of protection that you get from a Treasury bond fund. I know Treasuries pay next to nothing, but I've always believed that bond funds were for safety, not for speculation. So this brings me down to my basic investment strategy, 3 index funds, total market, U.S., total market international, high-quality government bond. That's enough. You can do more if you want to, but that is all you need for successful long-term investing. And by the way, if you're investing outside a retirement account instead of treasuries, you can use high-grade municipals. But don't go too far into bonds when you get a little older and you're thinking about it. Some people reach their 50s or 60s and they say, well, now I need an all-income investment. I'm going to do CDs, I'm going to do bonds, that's all. And why would you be doing that? You're still going to live another 20, 25 years. At 60, you are still a long-term investor, and you need to think about it that way. Bond funds will help you pay for the first half of your retirement, but you need stock funds and the growth they produce to make it to the second half of your retirement. If you aren't sure about how to allocate between stocks and bonds, there's a type of mutual fund called a target date fund. And that makes the decision for you based on your age, based on the year when you say you're likely to retire. Most 401k plans offer target date funds, and you can buy them independently, too. So when you're younger and saving for the future, your main strategy is more. More saving, more stock investments, better job, more earnings. Maybe you have a target, if I have X thousand dollars, I can afford to retire, but it's more, more, more. But when you're older and then you start thinking about retirement for real, your attitude flips. Instead of just thinking of a pot of money that's growing larger, you look at that pot and you say, okay, how much can I withdraw from this pot year by year by year and still make it to 90 plus, or in my case, 101. All of a sudden you start looking at this as an income stream, and you've got to solve that problem. How much can you afford to withdraw when you don't know how long you're going to live? Now, to answer that question, the first thing you do is what I call right-sizing your life. That means figure out how much income you're going to have in retirement and arranging your lifestyle to match. You don't ask, when you're doing retirement planning, how much income am I going to need? That's backwards. You ask, how much do I have and what reasonable amount of income can I take from that? It's a whole different way of looking at your savings. So how are you going to construct how much income you're going to have? You've got Social Security, and yes, it will be there. If you want to ask me about that later, we can. But yes, you will have Social Security. If you have a pension, you'll have that. Perhaps you have an annuity or some other source of income. You'll have a part-time job, maybe. And then you'll have whatever money you expect to withdraw prudently from your savings. That's going to be your retirement income. And then you look at your expenses, how much you expect to spend in retirement. And some people will do that and discover, to their surprise, that the income they expect will cover their expenses. What about that? They're astonished. You can go on and have a wonderful time. Some people will discover that actually they're going to have to take some nips and tucks in their spending. Others will discover that there is a big gap. And if there's a big gap, then you have to do something drastic, and the sooner you think about that, the better off you are. Maybe you say, I can't afford to retire, I won't. You say, I'm going to sell my house and rent. There are things that you do if there is this gap. The critical question is, how much can you really afford to withdraw from your savings and have it last for 30 years? And research has shown that sort of the magic number that you should work from to start with is 4%. Take 4% from your savings in the first year you retire, the year after that, and you take the same dollar amount plus an inflation adjustment, and you go on that way year after year. And research has shown that if you follow that schedule, your savings, however large or small they are, will last for at least 30 years. Furthermore, they will get you through, and what has been in the past, the worst possible economic times in America. They get you through the 30s. It would have gotten you through the stagflation of the 60s and 70s. If you were well diversified, you could take U.S. stocks, international stocks, you could take 4.5%. In some cases, you could take 5%. This becomes an exercise in how you invest and what you expect from your savings, but that's the way you need to look at how much retirement income am I going to have. Social Security, pension, amount prudently taken from savings, say, basically, as against your expenses. Everyone eventually figures out how to live on the amount of money they have when they arrive at retirement, for better or for worse. The sooner you look at what your options are likely to be, the easier it will be to piece together a future, good future life for yourself. Now, the steps for making these kinds of income projections are in my book. Too complicated to go through them here, as are particular investments and annuities and other subjects like that that have to do with how long your money will last. Here I'll say nothing matters to you more to the financial success of your retirement than right-sizing your life. Managing spending is far more effective than searching for a better mutual fund or a higher interest rate. You can adjust your investments later, but first establish a standard of living that you can afford for 30 years. So let's do priorities very quickly. We've talked about a lot of things having to do with your money today, but you can't do everything, so what should your priorities be? And I'd list them in this order. Start getting rid of your credit card debt. At the same time, start putting a modest amount of money into a retirement account to establish the habit. When the credit card debt is gone, start building an emergency savings account that could tide you over 6 months. Once that's done, increase the amount of money you're putting in your retirement account. Only then should you start saving money to help children with higher education. Children have options. They can go to a less expensive school, they can take student loans. If you expect to pay for college, that's fine, but you should save for your own retirement first. They can borrow their way through college, you cannot borrow your way through retirement. Also, much as we love our children, I would be very reluctant to co-sign a student loan from a private lender. Because if anything happened to your child or your child's income couldn't pay, the lender will come after you, you can't get rid of the loan in bankruptcy, and they can even garnish a Social Security check. So it's very hard for loving parents to say no, but I am not good with co-signing student loans. Once your savings are in order, you might want to start prepaying your mortgage. That is last on my list, but it's nice to enter retirement with a paid-up house. And as for investments, as you've heard, the surprising truth is that simple, low-cost financial products are actually the best ones. You can make a simple allocation and know that it's going to work for you for life. Simple is actually sophisticated. It's not simple. It is the best thing you can do. So I feel a little breathless after galloping through all this personal finance in my last half hour. You'll notice, by the way, that I gave no space in this talk to opposing points of view. Opposing points of view are wrong. I was reading some angry letters once from readers who disagreed vigorously with something I'd said in a Newsweek column, and my friend stuck her head in the door and said, never mind, Jane. She said, many enemies, much honor. And I said, that's terrific. Who said that? And she said, Mussolini. So I have been up here dictating to you about your personal investments, but I have been covering this field for many, many years, and I've seen fads come and go, and I've seen so-called sophisticated investments fail. I know that the simplest way is best. So thank you for coming. I very much appreciate you coming.
I was tweeting my way through trying to get all of Jane's advice in a nutshell, and you can't do that, so you do have to buy her book. We do want to allow a few minutes for questions. There's microphones in the aisle, so if anybody wants to step up and ask a question, we only have a few minutes, but we'll try to get a couple of them in, and we have a brave question person.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks, Jane, for your common sense advice. We really need it since we don't get any financial education in schools. My name's Stephanie McCullough. I do holistic financial planning for professional women. I agree with your advice that the simple is the best way, but it's simple is not always easy, especially when it comes to managing our cash flow and our spending. Can you comment on that idea of how do we get ourselves to do what we know we should be doing?
I think that manage your cash flow and your spending, I think that you start with putting money into savings and do automatic savings. If you do that, the rest of things will start falling into line. I mean, that is a very simple thing to do, but you know, you can budget automatically. Once you put the money aside from savings and you're investing it well, after that, I really don't care what you do, as long as you're just spending what's in your checking account, but you've got savings building up. How simple is that? Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Mary Skirm. Thank you so much for your presentation. I wanted to know what your thoughts were about long-term care insurance.
Long-term care. I have long-term care insurance. My late husband did not, and we had a very difficult, he couldn't qualify. We had a very difficult time of it. It was very expensive to take care of him at home. He died about 10 years ago. It was $100,000 a year by that net after tax, right? It's very expensive. I am happy to say that I was fortunate enough to remarry, but when my current husband was courting me, I said to him, do you have long-term care insurance? And he said, no, and I said, get it, it's a deal breaker. And he did, and we got married. But the thing about long-term care insurance is expensive. So it is a luxury purchase. If you cannot afford it, then what is going to happen is you're going to depend on your kids, or eventually you will depend on the Medicaid program after you have spent your money or your savings down. If you're a single person, it's okay to spend it down. If you have a house, you'll sell it. You know, you can afford your own long-term care for some period of time. If you are married, then one of you goes to a nursing home and the other one doesn't. That's where it becomes more difficult. If you can afford long-term care insurance and you're married, I highly recommend that you look at it. Understanding that it's important, that it's expensive, but I think it's a worthwhile purchase. But you shouldn't kill yourself so that you can't live if you can't, because you don't want to be in a situation where you buy it for several years and then you can't afford it anymore, which happens to some people. So it's an upper middle income purchase. Below that, it will be Medicaid, but if you can afford it, I'd look at it. Yes.
I have a quick question about disability insurance. I'm self-employed. I have my own health insurance, and I'm debating whether to get disability insurance. I'm 52.
Disability insurance, I think, are you married?
I'm not.
I think it's more important with a married couple, actually, than for a single, because if it's a two-income family and one of you is disabled and can't work, that's tough. If you are by yourself and you get disability insurance and you can't work anymore, it is actually less important because you will have other resources that you can fall back on and you're not supporting anybody else. If you have disability insurance, well, you're self-employed, so it's not at the workplace. place. I didn't put that on my list. I put it lower on the list just for the reason that it's expensive. But if you've got all those other things that you need in terms of your savings and investments, then I'd look at it.
Yeah, because I thought for the money I would spend on disability, maybe I should just put that towards my retirement.
Actually, I've been self-employed almost all my life, and that was my choice. I mean, I lucked out. I might have felt differently if I'd become disabled, but that's what I did.
Okay, thanks.
Yep.
Hi, Jane. You talked about paying off your mortgage so that you can go into retirement mortgage free. But a lot of people depend on their mortgage. They pay their taxes in with their mortgage. So now you've paid off your mortgage, but every year you're looking at a $10,000 tax bill that you didn't see because it came out of your mortgage every month. How do you handle that situation?
A $10,000 tax bill.
That's what my bill is a year.
You're talking about your property tax.
Property tax.
Oh, your property
income.
Tax.
Yes, property tax.
Okay, all right. But look at it this way. Before, you were paying down your loan and you were paying your property taxes, so you were paying more. If you're not paying the loan part, all you have is the property tax part, so you are paying less out of your income. So many people say, I need a mortgage because I need a tax deduction. You never need a tax deduction.
Okay.
It costs you more to carry the mortgage and take the tax deduction for whatever small percentage of the mortgage it is than it is to get rid of the mortgage.
Okay.
So, you know, you're going to pay less. You can afford your property taxes if you're not also paying the bank for the loan.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yep.
Hi, I have a 401k, and I also, a long time ago, invested in IBM, and it grew a ton. And now, I know you said do not own individual stocks, but what do you recommend if you have that money? Would you put it into the 401k, or I don't know what to do?
Well, you can't put, if you have money outside of 401k, you can't suddenly switch it in. You have an outside investment. I think that you are too heavily invested in IBM. You will probably have some capital gains taxes to pay. Perhaps you should divest yourself of IBM over time so you don't have a big chunk of capital gains to pay all at once, but you would be better off diversified in a mutual fund than having so much of your savings dependent on that one company, which has been disappointing.
Okay. All right, thank you very
yes.
much.
I think I can do quickly. Can I do quickly?
You mentioned prepaying your mortgage. Would you recommend that if you're, like, I'm not planning to retire in Pennsylvania, so I have a house now, but should I start prepaying that now, even though I'm going to move in 5 or 10 years, or is that
should
not
you
worthwhile?
Should you prepay your mortgage?
I've done all the other
only
things.
If you credit card debt, you're doing your savings to the full, you've got all plenty of retirement yeah. savings, and you're looking around for something else to do. Prepay your mortgage, why not?
It's
at the bottom of my list.
I'm obviously not going to pay off the house in the next five years, but it would still be worthwhile.
No, I mean, prepaying your mortgage, you know, you lose a tax deduction, you gain more money. Okay.
Thank you.
I think I have to stop, but the last three of you, come on up here, and I will do your question. Thank you again for coming. Thank you.